back, Questions Medicine 2021. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dial, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm reading about, talking about, thinking about, what the discussion is at my dinner table. That is all of today's papers. And as a reminder, if you learn one thing, if you learn anything at all, then there is no greater compliment than to pass this podcast along to one other person. So, without any further hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. I think we can all agree that the pandemic has brought about way more good and bad things than any of us ever expected. Some of the bad things were staying home from school or kids not going to school. This is not good for anyone, parents or the kids or our future. One of the good things was that there was more colon cancer screening from home. This is good. I've been ranting about this forever now, or at least it seems like forever, that colon cancer and cervical cancer and a lot of these cancers should be screened from home. We do not need the patients to come into the clinic or into the hospital or into the surgical suite in order to do these screenings, and we shouldn't be doing that. Well, that is maybe no more clearly seen or talked about than in this paper in JAMA titled, "The Push for Timely Follow-up After Abdominal At-Home Colon Cancer Screening Results." And in this article, it talks about the need to make sure that patients, if they do at-home colon cancer screening, they get a follow-up colonoscopy. The article points out one study where only 44% of the positive FIT test, had completed a colonoscopy within 6 months of the positive FIT test. And this was despite 89%, or almost 9 in 10, people having received a referral. So just because you had a positive FIT test, you got the referral to get a colonoscopy, you were not actually going to get the colonoscopy. This is really important because the FIT test is a really good screening test, and I'll talk about that in just a second. Now, the authors discuss the low rates or the complex reasons that patients are not getting these follow-up colonoscopies, and the answer is likely multifactorial, as it is with all of medicine. I mean, physicians don't always convey the importance of follow-up. Physicians don't always say, listen, this is a really sensitive test. This is a really good test. This has a high index, or I now have a high index of suspicion that you may have colon cancer. We need to make sure that you get a colonoscopy. Or the patients just may not have the funds to do it. They may not have transportation. They may not really care about getting a colonoscopy. They may not care about colon cancer. They may not understand the severity of colon cancer. Or the facilities, because of COVID or what have you, may be backed up in their scheduling. There are so many factors that go into this, but I think the real takeaway here is that we as providers must make sure that the patient understands the importance of this test. And I would never say that we should scare a patient. I would never say that. But I would say that we should definitely make sure that they understand how good a FIT test is, and that likely, or it is at least significantly more likely with a positive test, that they have colon cancer, and we need to get that followed up. And you may be saying, well, how likely is it, Andrew? How good is the FIT test? How good should, or how much should I warn my patient? Well, let's go back to 2018 in a paper titled Long-Term Performance of Colorectal Cancer Screening Programs Based on the Fecal Immunochemical Test, or aka the FIT test. And they found over a 10-year period, the rates or detection of colorectal cancer and advanced adenomas, the things we care about, colon cancer, using either a FIT test or colonoscopy was similar. There was no statistical difference between getting a colonoscopy or using a FIT test when you looked at the 10-year follow-up. That is pretty darn good. I mean, they might as well just be getting the colonoscopy, except they don't have to go through all the terrible prep most of the time. And you say, yeah, sure, it's as good as a colonoscopy, but how good is it? Give me some numbers. Give me some objective data. Well, I got your objective data right here. Let's go back to New England Journal of Medicine 2014 paper titled Multi-Target Stool DNA Testing for Colorectal Cancer Screening. And in that paper, they found that a FIT test was 74% sensitive and 95% specific, which in patient terms, it means for every 11 positive FIT tests, there was one cancer detected on colonoscopy. So if you have a positive FIT test, you can look at your patient and say, we have this positive FIT test. There is a 1 in 10 chance that we go to colonoscopy and we're going to find cancer. This is a big deal. 10% event rate or 10% incidence is something that we do all the time in medicine. If we had anything that was a number needed to treat of 1 in 10, we would use it like hydroxychloroquine at the beginning of the COVID pandemic. I mean, 1 in 10 is a big deal, and we need to make sure that our patients understand this and follow up with our GI colleagues. And speaking of following up, what about the patients that come into your office and they report that their knee kind of hurts and that there's these mechanical symptoms, and then maybe you ask or they just offer it up about popping, clicking, and pain on pivoting? This usually, almost always, gets you a follow-up with an orthopedic surgeon. And the patient usually then goes on to get arthroscopic knee surgery for these symptoms that we think are related to a meniscus tear. Yes, the old board exam question, the typical dogma of popping, clicking, or pain with pivoting, we almost always associate with meniscus tears. But I ask you, where does this come from? Is this true? Is this textbook? Is this dogma? Is this just board question? What about this actually makes sense? What about this actually comes from evidence? Well, we are in luck, because now we have this paper titled "Meniscal and Mechanical Symptoms Are Associated with Cartilage Damage, Not Meniscal Pathology." The title kind of gives away the rest of the study, but this was in the Journal of Bone Joint Surgery in March 3rd, 2021. And in this study, the researchers prospectively evaluated 565 patients, mean age 48, who had arthroscopic knee surgery for symptoms connected to meniscus pathology, or what we believe to be meniscus pathology. Prior to having surgery, patients were asked about the presence and severity of symptoms prior to the surgery. And then, while in the surgery, the surgeon recorded the characteristics of meniscus tears and the severity of cartilage damage. And in the end, and I quote from the authors, "We did not observe an association between meniscus pathology and preoperative patient-reported knee symptoms. Instead, we found overall symptom severity was driven particularly by the catching, locking, clicking, and popping was driven particularly by the significance of the cartilage damage." Yes, that is right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, clicking, snapping, popping, locking, little pain, little twisting, the things that we say, oh, that's got to be a meniscus, was driven by cartilage damage. And if you were one of these unlucky patients that had tricompartmental cartilage damage, meaning cartilage damage in the medial, lateral, and patellofemoral area, then there was an even greater symptom severity. You had even greater symptoms if you had worse cartilage damage all throughout your knee. This is what we could all say is a dose response of cartilage damage to symptom severity. The more bad, or the more areas that you had cartilage damage, the more severe your symptoms were. A dose response. One of the things that we always want to look for in any observational trial. And there you have it. And perhaps, yes, just maybe perhaps, this study helps explain why arthroscopic meniscus surgery has not consistently proven to be beneficial than just, or least beneficial over, just regular conservative management in randomized controlled trials. Sure, if there's trauma, don't get me wrong, I will stand back and we need the surgeons to cut. But if there's not trauma, well then arthroscopic meniscus surgery has really not beat sham very often at all. And the better the trial is, the more likely it is that it's not going to benefit. And with that, let's move on to the next article, which is the FDA. Yes, the FDA, they're back at it again, and they have released a new test, a new point of care test that they've never released before. And it is a point of care test that will now be used, hopefully, in an office near you. The U.S. Food Food and Drug Administration announced that it is allowing the use of Binks Health Assay for point-of-care testing for chlamydia and gonorrhea. The test, which uses female vaginal swabs and male urine specimen, takes about 30 minutes and can be done right there in your office. This is fantastic because then we will have the results and we can treat the patient right there in our office. And do not forget, there is new recommendations on the doses of or in the treatment of chlamydia and gonorrhea, especially if they have gonorrhea, the treatment then of chlamydia with doxycycline. So make sure you go back in previous episodes, top articles of 2020, if you missed that, to make sure that you're up to date on the current doses and the recommendations for treatment. And I have absolutely zero idea how much this test is going to cost, but my guess is it'll be a pretty penny, probably not too much, because they own the market share and they're going to want everyone to do it, and they need to keep it at least in line with the cost that it would cost you, the provider, to send off the lab test to an outpatient lab. They're gonna wanna keep it about the exact same. So it's gonna cost a little bit, but insurance should hopefully pay for it, and it shouldn't be insane amount because they're gonna wanna stay competitive with the outpatient labs. So with that, let's move on to the next article. And the next paper is titled Rivaroxaban in Patients with Atrial Fibrillation and a Bioprosthetic Mitral Valve. This is a game changer. If you haven't got the warning yet, this paper is a game changer, so listen up. This paper in the New England Journal of Medicine was an open-label design randomized trial of just over 1,000 patients who were randomized to either 20 milligrams once daily of rivaroxaban versus dose-adjusted warfarin in patients with atrial fibrillation and a bioprosthetic mitral valve. If you recall back from the AHA, ACC guidelines for anticoagulation, we would say warfarin was the standard of care. If you have AFib, we should give DOACs for everyone, unless, of course, it was a bioprosthetic mitral valve, a mechanical mitral valve, or moderate to severe mitral stenosis. But as you recall, in one of the last podcasts, I told you about an article that recently came out where just maybe, we should also now be doing DOACs for moderate to severe mitral stenosis. So now it's just the valves. It's just valve replacement that we really need to know about. And this study is a game changer. In this study where they compared the 1,000 patients with rivaroxaban or warfarin, the primary outcome was a composite of death, major cardiovascular events such as stroke, TIAs, a systemic embolism, valve thrombosis, or hospitalization for heart failure, or major bleeding. And they looked at the follow-up at 12 months and they said, what is the difference between these two groups? And in the end, they found that in patients with atrial fibrillation and a bioprosthetic mitral valve, which we always used to give warfarin for, rivaroxaban was non-inferior to warfarin when it came to the composite primary outcome of death, major cardiovascular events, or major bleeding at 12 months. Now, I do have a couple problems with the study. First of all, it is industry-funded and open-label design. That it's immediate bias right from the beginning. People doing the trial are getting paid to do the trial, both the patients and the researchers, and they're getting paid to enroll people. And they want this to work because they're getting paid and they believe in it. You only go on a trial if you believe in what you're doing. And if you don't believe in what you're doing, well, then soon thereafter, you won't be able to sleep at night. So you convince yourself to believe in what you're doing. This is immediate bias and part of my problem. I don't know why they couldn't have just double blinded this. However, it is what it is. And this is not necessarily a problem, but something that needs to be noted. This is bioprosthetic mitral valves, not mechanical valves. So if the patient has a mechanical valve, this does not apply. I will say, however, that this data with this bioprosthetic mitral valve does seem to be consistent with other observational data and subgroup analysis from other studies. So this is likely game-changing. This is likely, for me, practice-changing going forward. This is real. This is super real. And let's talk mental health. ADHD is real. And what do you write for? Well, if we just had a large meta-analysis of almost 24,000 people, then maybe we would know what medication is best, safest to use. And we are in luck, because in this paper in The Lancet Psychiatry titled Comparative efficacy and tolerability of medications for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder in children, adolescents, and adults, a systematic review and network meta-analysis. In this paper, the researchers examined the efficacy and tolerability of data on the drugs used to treat ADHD. They looked at all kinds of trials, and in the end, they came up with 133 trials that included 14,000 children and 10,000 adults. They did the analysis, and they were able to use indirect comparison, which is when you take one study active arm and you compare it with another study active arm, and in a bit of statistical magic and a little bit of voodoo with a little bit of fairy dust, you get what appears to be a trial that involves two active arms. So to use as a very simple example, if you have one trial that shows aspirin versus placebo to treat whatever it is, disease X, and then you have another trial that's Plavix versus placebo to treat disease X, you then do an indirect comparison, which is using a little bit of statistical magic, a little bit of fairy dust, and then boom, all of a sudden you get this paper or this document or the results that would be somewhat comparable to aspirin versus Plavix. Now, it's not the exact same. They didn't use the same patients, but by using two separate trials in the active arm, you then can mash them together and you have aspirin versus Plavix, and you can look to see which one is better. Is this perfect? No way. Is it better than nothing? Usually. It's something that is commonly used when we don't have head-to-head trials to tell us which drug is actually best. So let's get to the results. ADHD. What do we use to treat it? Well, the results were really interesting. For children, if you looked at the teacher's rating, which is really the thing that we care about for children, how do they do in school? And not necessarily how do they do in school when mom is there or dad is there to beat their behind, but when the teacher is there trying to teach them and they have to sit in school for a long period of time. How do they do in school? Well, only methylphenidate and modafinil, yes, methylphenidate and modafinil were effective compared to placebo. All the other ADHD medications did not beat placebo when it came to children. And one of the things that's also really interesting is that modafinil did not beat placebo for adults. So you have one drug that's beneficial in children, but not in adults. So what did you use for adults? Well, the best drug for adults was amphetamines. I think one of the authors who commented on this study said it best when they said, results favored using methylphenidate in children and adolescents and amphetamines in adults as first-line short-term treatment. The authors did look for data at 26 and 52 weeks, but they found insufficient evidence. The evidence I'm telling you about is at 12 weeks and under, because that's the way the studies were done. So yes, for children, you should be using methylphenidate. For adults, you should be using amphetamines. The reason being is that they work well and they have long safety data to support them. But we don't know what these drugs do in the long term. Just like all mental health, the trials were done for a short period of time, and we have no information on what the long-term risk or benefits of these drugs really are. So I think it is important to not only use methylphenidate for children and amphetamines for adults, but to use drug holidays whenever possible. These drugs have evidence for 12 weeks, and we have no idea what to do long-term because the evidence isn't long-term. We just don't have evidence for 12, 22, 32, 42 years later. And this will be an interesting thing going forward when we have these long-term observational trials of children that have been on these medications for 40 or 50 years. Let's move on to the next article. And the next article will be the last article, and then I'll wrap up this podcast as I've wrapped up every single one before it. So here we go. It is a paper in JAMA titled Effect of Low Intensity versus High Intensity Home-Based Walking Exercise on Walk Distance in Patients with Peripheral Arterial Disease, the LIGHT Randomized Clinical Trial. How long or fast do you need to walk if you have peripheral artery artery disease. I think everyone agrees that if you have peripheral artery disease, you need to exercise. The guidelines agree. You need to exercise. And the guidelines say you should do high intensity exercise. But the question lingers is that normally exercise, even a little bit of exercise, even like 2 minutes of exercise seems to be beneficial. So would maybe, just maybe, low intensity exercise work? Would low intensity walking actually work? Does low intensity maybe work just as good as high intensity? We didn't have data to support this. Well, in this study, they took 305 participants with peripheral arterial disease and randomized them to either low intensity exercise, high intensity exercise, or a control group with absolutely no exercise at all. The participants in the walk groups were asked to walk 5 times per week for up to 50 minutes per session, wearing an accelerometer so that way we could document how fast and how intense and how long you were walking. The intense group walked at a pace without ischemic leg symptoms. The low intensity group, no ischemic leg symptoms. So they said, walk, but do not get pain in your legs. If you get pain in your legs, don't do it. Do not do it. That's a low intensity group. The high intensity group, they said, we want you to walk and we want you to have some pain. No pain, no gain, baby. We want you to go at a pace at which you have moderate to severe ischemic leg symptoms. Push it to the limit, they say. And they did weekly phone calls from a, quote, coach. I'm using air quotes here, but they did weekly phone calls from an air coach to a coach to make sure that there was adherence. And I will say that the adherence was actually pretty good, around 85%. That's really impressive to get people to walk 5 times a week. And in the end, they did a 6-minute walk test at the beginning of the study and a 6-minute walk test at the end of the study. And the primary outcome was the change in distance in that 6-minute walk test at 12 months. So over the course of the year, how much further can you walk? Or maybe you can't walk any further at all. If you did nothing at all, if you were in the group that got randomized to do nothing at all, no exercise at all, well then at the end of this whole 12-month, year-long process, you lost 15 meters in your 6-minute walk test. 15 meters. It's not a lot, but over the course of the year, to lose 15 meters is definitely something. If you were in the high-intensity group, you gained 35 meters on your 6-minute walk test. I would say that's pretty significant. 35 meters, or you think about it in America, 35 yards, is a pretty significant distance to increase your walking, especially when you already have peripheral artery disease. This is pretty good. You're not in the best shape. Just by the fact that you have peripheral artery disease, I can say that you are not a marathoner. I mean, you're probably getting your exercise not super frequent before you were enrolled in this trial. But that's not what we care about. We know the people that didn't walk at all lost 15 meters. We know the people that walked really high intensity with pain, no gain, they gained 35 meters. So what about the individuals in the low intensity group? Well, if you were randomized to the low intensity group, the ones that said, we want you to walk, but don't push it, don't have any pain, well then you had a decrease in the distance that you were able to walk at the end of 12 months. Those individuals went down by 6.5 meters. Yes, it's true what they say. No pain, no gain. If you have peripheral arterial disease, you can lollygag your walk around the block. You go really slow, but realistically, you should probably push it to the limits. You should probably have no pain, no gain. And this is what we should tell our patients to do. I know that you have peripheral arterial disease. I know that it is painful to walk. I know that you're not going to die. I know it is beneficial for you to push it just a little bit harder than what you're normally comfortable doing, because that will get you gains. That will get you improvement in your 6-minute walk test. And although you may not agree with the outcome of a 6-minute walk test and the distance walked during a 6-minute walk test, for peripheral arterial disease, that is the standard by which we measure all treatment modalities against, is the 6-minute walk test. So it is what it is. And now let's recap the articles I talked about today before this ship sets sail in a sea of evidence. Starting from the top, because that's usually the best place to start, it is colon cancer screening. We know that people are getting fit tests at home, and that's a really good thing because they don't need to come in the office to get a fit test. However, they're not following up once they have a positive test. And we know that roughly 1 in 10 fit tests will be positive for colon cancer. So it is really, really important for at least 1 out of 10 people to make sure that they follow up. The problem is we don't know which one is the 1 in 10, and we don't know which one is the false positive at 9 in 10. Either way, it's important that your patient understands this risk and they follow up with our colleagues, the gastroenterologist. And speaking of following up, what about mechanical symptoms? Popping, clicking, pain, pivoting. If you look at a board exam, any board exam probably ever taken, if you heard anything with knee pain and popping, clicking, pain, and pivoting, the answer would almost always be meniscus. However, that does not appear to be the case. That is not the case, at least in this paper. The association with cartilage damage had way more of an effect, if you looked at the cartilage damage that was inside the knee, not the meniscus damage. So maybe we should change our board exams and our board questions. What about the FDA? They are back at it, approving things left and right, and now they have approved Binks Health Assay. It is the first ever point of care test for chlamydia and gonorrhea testing in the office. Look for it in an office near you, or maybe you can get it in your office. Who knows? And what about rivaroxaban? Rivaroxaban for atrial fibrillation and bioprosthetic mitral valve. It is equal, non-inferior to warfarin. We used to say warfarin was needed for moderate or severe mitral stenosis. That was what the guidelines say, and now we know from previous podcasts that I recorded on that that's not the case. We also used to say warfarin is needed for a bioprosthetic mitral valve. We now know, nope, rivaroxaban is non-inferior, so it should probably be rivaroxaban. And we used to say warfarin is needed for a mechanical valve. We still say warfarin is needed for a mechanical valve, but it's the only one. It's the last of a dying breed. It's a dinosaur, if you will. And I suspect that there will be a day in the future that maybe even that will go by the wayside. And what about the patient that has ADHD? What do you do with the patient that has ADHD? Well, if they are a child, then the best drug based on safety and efficacy appears to be methylphenidate. If they're an adult, then first line appears to be amphetamines. These are two drugs, methylphenidate and amphetamines, that have good evidence on them for efficacy and safety in children and adults respectively. However, that data is really limited to 12 weeks or less. We don't know anything even to 26 or 52 weeks. We don't have that evidence. We don't even have evidence at 26 weeks. Ponder that. It is important that we take drug holidays and that we share with our patients that, listen, this is the limitation of the drug, and we don't really know what this means long term. So if you're starting this drug at 10, 15, 20 years old, and you plan to use it till you're 40, 45, 50, 55, and you don't grow out of ADHD, well then we may have long-term problems because we don't have that evidence currently. And last but not least, it is exercise. Exercise with peripheral artery disease. Sure, doing nothing, you'll lose a lot in your 6-minute walk test. With low intensity, you're still gonna lose, but you're not gonna lose as much. But if you really wanna make gains, no pain, no gain. You gotta push the exercise. You have to push the walking 5 times a week for 50 minutes to the point where you have moderate to severe ischemic leg pain. That is the driving force in making sure that you can increase your 6-minute walk test. And with that, I will end this podcast as I've ended every single one before it. Wait for the music. Until next time, keep the quest in questioning.